He's a brilliant chair. This is my chair, Adam. He's going to keep us all in order. Dominic, Lord Dominic, he's going to keep us all in order. Yeah. I'm very pleased to be here. I was on the internet the other day, clicking away like you do, and I seen the Oxford Working Class Book Fair, and I seen they were talking about the levellers and the diggers and all that, and I sent them an email so I could talk about it, and do you know what? They actually believed me. So here I am. I first got involved in this sort of history, I suppose, when I was doing a bit on the Kingswood Miners. I'm going to talk a little bit more about them during the talk, because I do know quite a bit about them. And they're free miners, a bit like the Forest of Dean. I don't know if you ever come across them. But they squatted the forest. I'll develop it a little bit more, but it was just about land usage and common land. And I realised that we'd actually lost these rights over a period of time, wondered how it had happened. So, I mean, I know my blurb on the website, I said I was going to start around the English Revolution, but I don't think I can really. I think we need to go all the way back to when we were living in caves, obviously, because then the land was obviously ours. We were chasing mammoths about and clubbing up saber-toothed tiger, having barbecues every night. Life was great. And then we started planting crops, didn't we? And then we got the surplus value, and then we started building fences, and then you got the chief. And with the chief, I think, came the decline in social model, if you like. Because basically what happened there, I mean, admittedly, in some places were looser controlled than others. And like the Saxons, you remember the Saxons, you have the folk moots and such like. So now the chief could actually be withdrawn or displaced if he or she wasn't up to scratch. But on the whole, it started to strengthen, didn't it? And you've got families and clans, and it was normally based on clans and kinship. And then eventually we got the monarchs. I mean, in Britain you had Wessex and Mercia, and you know, you had Offa's Dyke and such like, you know. And then of course we had the Normans, and that's when it really started to go tits up, I believe, you know. And in fact, if you read about the English Revolution, they do refer to it Norman Yo. Anyway, what was his name? William the Bastard to his friends, but I think he's referred to as William Conqueror in the history books, came over here with a gang of mercenaries. They were nothing more, nothing less. You know, they'd done a lot of damage in Britain. They'd even, killed one third of his peasantry in Normandy because they basically had a pre-poll tax riot uprising. And he cast his eye over here, and over he came. And he was very clear on how to run the country. Yeah, he set up castles and basically the Doomsday Book followed, and then the land started to be parcelled out. Because common land, I mean, it isn't held, it is sort of held in common, but it was still owned. Every bit of this country has always, really, since that day, been owned by somebody or other. So how did common land come about? Well, basically, what it was is like underneath feudalism, which came out of the Norman Revolution. I mean, it was already there before, but that's when it really got nailed down, because I've just sick in this country. Basically, the landed gentry or the king of the manor or whatever would plough some fields, but some would be left to waste. Like the Fenlands is a very good example. You know, very difficult to drain. I don't know a great deal about it, but I don't think it was the 18th or 19th century until the Fenlands were actually drained. But forests, wastelands, this was sometimes left, and people could use it. Now, sometimes as well, what would happen is there'd be quite a few different arrangements, quite a few different arrangements dependent on the law of the manor. Sometimes you get people who would actually rent a cottage, and with that cottage would come a certain amount of rights. They'd be allowed to, say, graze two cows, a couple of pigs and some geese. But also the value of the commons, I believe, is very important as well. There's loads you could get from them. And in fact, a family could be pretty much self-sustaining on the commons. You know, I spoke about the livestock, but they could get wood, and wood would be very important, obviously, for building, for thatching, for burning, for making tools, all that sort of thing. Furs is like peat. You know, you could dig it and once again it for building. And also, and sometimes you could actually sell it people who didn't have the common. That, once again, would be very much down to localised agreements. Anyway, getting back to the English Revolution, obviously what happened then was we locked Charlie's head off, and then all bets were off a little bit, and this is where I really got interested in the Kingswood Forest, because the Kingswood Forest, as the name suggests, and forests were very much seen at this time across the country as being a place outside of the law. You know, we've got the Robin Hood scenario, haven't we? But even during that, outlaws would go to the forest and such likes. But most forests in this country were held by the crown. most of them were also held, and there'd be sort of like hunting lodges on there, and like the crown, or the court as it was, it would go off en masse, stop at one of these lodges, go and do a bit of hunting, eat the local produce if you like, and sometimes just take it a lot of the time, and then move around, and they just sort of move around like that. It was a bit like they're sort of like caravanning holiday, the ruling classes, I suppose. And Kingswood Forest was very important for this because it was one of the closest ones to London. It wasn't regularly used, but every few years, you know, the king would come out and he'd sort of do his bit and then move on again. Now, when we locked Charlie's head off, and there's two very important things, actually. I'm going back to the Levellers a little bit. I suppose you all know about the Levellers. The English Revolution, they felt they were fighting for levelling of society. And also at the same time, there was the diggers. Now, the diggers, I feel, were very important as well. Now, obviously, as historians, I spent most of this with my historians, we've got to look at these historical moments in time through their eyes. And they were looking at interpretation of the Bible. Now, the Bible doesn't mean anything like it does now. You know, I mean, I don't know how many of you are Christians out there, it's irrelevant, but basically, you know, in that day and age, of course, there was the tithes, and you had to go to church and what have you. It was all conducted in Latin, the Bible was in Latin, and of course, after Luther kicking off, and the knock-on effects over here with the English Revolution, people were actually reading the Bible. I mean, admittedly, most people couldn't read, but it would be read to them in the vernacular. And in there were strong suggestions that the land is ours. It's not somebody's to take away, you know, it should be held in common. And there was a very important person called Gerald Winstanley. I hate to use the word leaders, but he seems to be the most prominent person in the diggers, where he was just the most literate and wrote more pamphlets than any of the others, and therefore that's been. But he was he set up a commune outside London on St George's Hill. And several times, like, I mean, basically what that was, that was agricultural communism. The land was held, there was no gender break up, basically everybody farmed the land, worked the land, and they just took the produce off of it, but in a sustainable way as well. Now obviously the local landowners hated the idea of that, because if that caught on, all bets were off. Yeah, absolutely. So what the local landowners did is got a load of thugs and run them off. Excuse me. Now there are parallels with this day and age as well. I suspect most of you remember the Battle of the Beanfield and the Travellers, and even to this day and age, Battle of the Beanfield, basically, that was around Stonehenge, the Stonehenge Festival, and it was when the press used to call them the hippie convoy, they always called the peace convoy, but basically what they were was a group of autonomous travellers who didn't want anything more to do with society or the state, really, and would have convert buses. And cut a long story short, they would go, they'd split out in Somerset, Dorset, all round there and sort of camp up, but they used to come together with the summer solstice at Stonehenge, and the old Bill got them off down this side street and basically attacked them. You know, it's well documented. In fact, have a Google search and have a look at it. It's pretty horrific. I mean, women with children, their arms were truncheons to the floor. Their homes, their mobile buses were burnt and such likes, you know. And there's a strong feeling. I mean, the actual rationale behind it was they didn't work and all this. But the links are quite clear. I believe are quite clear. Okay, they didn't actually have a fix like the diggers, you know, like a piece of land. But they didn't want to engage in society, and they were choosing something else, and they were becoming quite popular, and people were starting to think about the philosophy and the lifestyle that they were undertaking. And even to this day, I mean, I'm elected rep chair of Bristol Unison. I actually work for the local government, and I know how they treat local travellers in Bristol, and it's pretty appalling. And it's all around, apparently, hygiene, you know, they haven't got proper toilets and such like. But I'll tell you nothing, if they bang you up, they expect you to shit in the bucket, you know, they're not so bothered about it then, you know. And also, I mean, I don't know if you heard about the bloke and the tenants dispute in Glasgow, you know, when they fitted the toilets, it didn't work and it wouldn't actually take toilet paper, you know. They tried to, so it, what I'm basically trying to say is a red herring, I digress slightly, I'm sorry. Yeah, but I mean, St George's Hill was crushed, so really were the Levellers, the Putney debates and such like. I suppose most of you heard about that, where the Levellers sat down with the senior generals of the English Revolution to basically say, what have we been fighting for, and what's the outcome? It's not what we thought it was. And worse than that, most of them weren't actually paid, which I'm going to take back to Kingswood now, because Unfortunately, I'm sure some of you know that what actually happened in part payment of the new model army is someone went out to Ireland and the massacre of Drogheda followed, and large amounts of southern noble island, as it was then, were parcelled off and given to Protestant soldiers as payment for serving in the English Civil War. One of the major ports they sailed from, obviously, was Bristol. Now, there had been a lot of squatting in Kingswood Forest, and it was well known, as I said, you know, the forest, even though they were the king's lands and there was a warden and such like, it still would be populated with outlaws. And the name is that, you know, if people were running for the law for one reason or another, they were with outlaws. You could actually kill them. You could legally kill them, and there'd be no sanction against you. But whole communities went up here. But you saw the squatting go through the roof. increased greatly, thank you very much, after the English Civil War. And I haven't actually nailed this down properly, but I know you shouldn't do this as a story, but I'm going to have a little pop on. I think a lot of the levellers who were going to be taken from Britain to Ireland to fight in this unjust war, actually legged it and squatted. Now, when they squatted, I'm going to go to the one-day house in a minute. I've told you about the wooden such lights, but Kingswood Forest is very, very rich in coal. Very rich in coal. And basically what they did is they literally just dug holes in the ground and mined. And over a period of time, the Kingswood coal got very, very important. In fact, it was absolutely sacrosanct absolutely important for Newcastle. Well, there was Newcastle coal, so for Bristol and Bath, the industrialisation of Bristol. You know, I mean, Bristol industrialised on Kingswood coal, there's no doubt about it. If it didn't have the Kingswood coal, it wouldn't have been as successful city as it actually was at the time.
What date is this now?
This is the sort of 1650s, 1660s. You know, I think the ships started going out from Bristol 1648 to 1650, but I think a lot of people sort of floated about. But I'll get on to a minute when the actual monarchy came back, and that's quite interesting as well. But yeah, the actual cottages, because they did still have to be recognised as such, because obviously there was common land attached to them, if you like, you know, and there was some sort of rights that was held by the community, and this is quite important as well. In common land, there had to be a degree of sustainability. You know, I said about the two cows and the two pigs and such likes. If someone had rights to two pigs and all of a sudden they put five on there, then obviously that's going to have a knock-on effect on the amount they graze. So therefore, at times, the actual commoners had to police their own common. And they had to do that in a fair and sustainable manner. But getting back to Kingswood, they were actually digging these mines all over the place. And at times there were sort of local landowners that also squatted for one, because when the crown actually collapsed and all the authority of the crown collapsed, some of the larger landowners sort of encroached on some of this forest. But to sustain their encroachments, they actually allowed this squatting as well. So it was like a I can scratch my back, I'll scratch your back relationship. You know, the squatters would also look to these large landowners to back them up, and they did so legally, because after the second Stuart, Charles II, got back onto the throne, there was legal attempts to remove these squatters. And the actual larger landowners, whose land ownership was very tenuous as well after the English Revolution, worked together with the squatters to defend it. But in 1670, after Charles II, there was massive riots up on the Kingswood Forest. The king, he came back, and one of the first things he wanted to do was reassert his authority. Obviously, I mean, they'd never seen anything like it in Britain before, but they actually regicide. And he needed to stamp his mark, and one of the things he thought would be a good idea was to reclaim the forests. So therefore, he appointed wardens. Now, this is one of my favourite stories, I've got to be honest. They put this warden in up at Kingswood Forest, and off he went. He had a quick look around, saw there was all these mines everywhere. I mean, literally, sort of holes going down into the ground. I mean, it was brutal work as well. I mean, you can't imagine what it would have been like, because it was candles in those days, obviously, no lights. You know, if a candle went out, you knew it was a gas leak, or black air, as they called it as well, that could be lethal. You'd actually be lowered down on a rope. You know, I mean, sometimes these holes would actually just be worked by a single family, you know, father and son. And that's something else that's important about commons, because even though you could actually have a sustainable life on a common, you probably do other things. You might have a blacksmith shop and you make so much out of the blacksmith shop, but also you'd have your little garden and you'd have your picks, if you like, and you could collect wood off the common to fuel your black, fuel your forge as well, you see. But anyway, this bright spark come down, a bloke called Tindley was. And he thought, I know what I'm going to do to show the crowns of fire. I'm going to restock the forest with deer. I mean, what a plank, honestly. He let six does and six stags go. And they ran off. And then he was surprised 2 days later and he couldn't find them. Yeah. The ones who hadn't fallen down the holes were obviously in a pot somewhere. You know, what a Muppet. I mean, that was obviously before the Muppet show. So you can't blame him for that. So then he started to use force. He thought, like, what I'll have to do is enforce this. And large-scale riots took place over 5 years. And eventually the crowd gave up. And Kingswood Forest, right up until the early 19th century, was still populated by free mining squatters. Unfortunately, what happened is due to the nature of the coal mining and such like, a lot of them started to sort of come together. They'd sort of come together to transport the goods in and such like. And now and again, somebody come and buy them, or they get amalgamated and such like. So some of these mines did become larger conglomerates, if you like, and it did lose its sort of individuality. But on the whole, the Kingswood miners, well, I mean, have a web search from them. They're amazing. Like, you know, they were regularly rioting against toll roads for obvious reasons. They had to take their coal into Bristol, then they had to pay toll on it. That would reduce their overall, increase their overheads greatly, and reduce what they could actually feed their kids on. But they'd also come down and help out with the bread riots I was speaking about earlier in the other room. Unfortunately, there was other times that were probably misused. They were certainly actually paid to support the Tories in local elections. And so I don't know if you ever heard about, you know, the pillory when they used to put people in stocks. You know, sometimes there was a fee owner, sometimes there were fee takers, and like bailiffs and bounty hunters. You know? And now and again, they'd be put in a stock, and they were in for a hard day. And there was one particular case where this actual bailiff would be put in for homosexuality, which was a crime at the time. And not only did he have an iron hat on, and all this brown paper over his clothes, because they used to throw dead cats, anything. I mean, if you're in the pillory, you could lose your eyes easily. But he also employed a load of Kingswood miners to defend him. He paid them something like a shilling, which was a lot of money in those days. A load of local scallies came down because this very unpopular thief taker was there, and a big punch up came on. But I'm not actually here to talk about Kingswood miners. I'm here to talk about the commons, the use of the commons. Another thing that I found amazing while I was reading about the commons was the one day out. Has anybody heard of that?
Yeah.
Right, it's a piece of law that I cannot nail down. And there's a Colin, I don't know if anybody's ever heard of Colin Walls. He writes, Colin Walls, he's an anarchist, he writes for Freedom Press and such likes, but he wrote Anarchy in Action, but he's written a lot about housing rights and such likes. And he's gone right back, and he can't find it, but he can find loads of examples of one day house across the world.
One day house.
And basically what it is, and it does slightly depend from region to region, but if you could get 4 walls up and smoke coming out of a chimney between dawn or dusk, some places dusk to dawn, then you could claim that land.
Mm.
Yeah, do you ever heard that? Yeah. And like, you know, it was quite regular, and it certainly happened in Kingswood. Now what that suggests is an element of community. No one's going to be able to do that on their own unless they've got a load of kids. So A, other people must have agreed with you being able to put up that house. So sometimes you could picture it, couldn't you, where sort of, you know, you had a daughter, he over there had a son, they got married, the families got together, built them a new house with this area, and they'd dig a mine, and on it would go. Do you know what I mean? It's like that. But also, I mean, there was other things about it, you know, that it couldn't get ripped down, and it would take the common land. But one of my favourite stories is, well, in some places, how much land would you get with it? You know, and in one place, what you had to do is, after you built the house, the occupant would stand with his back to the wall, and it wasn't normally the bloke, and you'll see why perhaps, and throw an axe. And how far they could throw this axe would be the land, and they'd have to do it from all 4 walls, you know. If you could picture at Kingswood, you know, the ranger, he's had an hard time already, all his deer have gone missing, and he turns up, and there was a party as well, it'd be a big party, you know, all the community get there, build this house, drinking cider at the time, you know. So he turns up in the morning, they're absolutely bladdered, been building this house, and there's some geezer lobbing an axe on. You'd let it go, wouldn't you? You would. You'd just ride on. There is, if actually if you go on Wikipedia, there is reference to 1588 Acts, which says that you could no longer do this. But it definitely, definitely, definitely happened in Kingswood and in the Forest of Dean after that. And I think that acts a red herring. I don't think it was ever rolled out. You know, there's also stories in Italy as well where it went off over a period of time where the actual family to be were going to buy the house, going to make the house, would go and collect art, you know, the equipment and get the stone and stuff like that. I mean, it depends on how rugged the house was, because that's something else. I mean, four walls. Sometimes what they do is just put up a very rough timber structure, just mud it, you know, clay and mud, and you've got your four walls, and then you build your stone around it over a period of time and put the windows in. So it was only really the four walls and the smoke coming out of the arm, that was the important bit. But as I said, in other areas, there'd be a long time before. You know, so there's obviously a bit of thought about it, you know. And also, I mean, something like the forest as well, you'd have to clear the land, really. Because even if, you know, even if you avoided the big trees, you're going to get... maybe this is going to be right. Yeah. You know, you'd still have the little ones and the scrub to do as well. But of course, then along came the Enclosure Acts. Now, this is one of the problems with common law. There's no such thing, really. You know, a lot of it is word of mouth. Very few of it was written down. Some of it have been passed down through history to history to history. You know, and you can imagine what it would be like, you know, from time to time you'd have, I mean, getting back to the blacksmith, you'd have fires and stuff like that, you know. There'd be a leak for your roof and the documents would get lost, you know. But if nobody ever challenged it, and why would they want to challenge it? It worked. You know, everybody was well fed, everybody got on well, you know, the community lived, you know. But then the Enclosure Acts came along, and that basically was when people started, you know, the mass agricultural farming, you know, when they actually sort of strip farmed the place and such like, you know, and people were trying to reclaim the waste, as they were calling it. And what basically the landowners were saying is this is a waste of resources, you know, we're not growing that much, we're not actually producing that much for the market. In fact, we could feed the working class better. So they try to put it behind paternalism, which is a load of rubbish, really. The working class are fine. I mean, division of labour, you know. I'd love something like that. You do a bit of that and get pissed off and that. You go and pull up your spuds, you know, and then you do something else and go and walk your cow around the market. It'd be lush, wouldn't it? But they started to enclose the land. And as we've heard, I mean, the enclosure rights were probably the most well-recorded rights in British history. You know, it didn't go down well. What the landowner would do is first off they apply for an act, and that would be an act of Parliament. Now, Parliament wouldn't sit that often, and literally it'd just be stamped. You know, you could put in a complaint against it, you could try to affect the situation, but unfortunately, 9 times out of 10, these people were illiterate, couldn't afford lawyers, the landowners could. You know, so it was such an unfair situation. They were beaten all the way down. Other than this, they could use their hands and their feet and their community. And it happened lots and lots of times. I mean, Bristol especially. But I'm going to take this time to big up South London Radical History. Have you ever heard of them? Anybody hear from them? You're here from them.
Oh, no, I'm not here from them, I've heard.
You've heard of them. Unfortunately, it looks as if they're in a bit of financial trouble now, but you might want to write this down if anybody's got a pen. Past Tense Publications. And they've got a PDF file on there that's free. In fact, if you see me later at the Bristol Radical Bookshop, I'll show you a copy. And you can just print off the internet, and it's brilliant. And that's loads of enclosure rights, loads of them. And on one occasion, the actual local, and this happened in other parts of the country as well, the local priest or vicar, whatever, led the rioters. Sometimes it was women who led the rioters as well, because there's certain things about women actually leading the riot now. You know, because the local militia, were not shooting a load of women. No way. I mean, the Luddites and Rebecca Rikes, they used to wear all these clothes, didn't they? Sometimes, but in fact, the Kingswood miners did as well. You find a lot of rioters in pre-industrial. There was other things about that. There's also like the there's an element of comedy and fate, if you like, turn the world upside down. There's an element of disguise. There's also an element that the militia wouldn't shoot on you. You know, but you know, at times they'd throw down the fences and restart to replant, or just let their cows loose on it and such like. Because the actual outcome of the enclosure as well, it wasn't at times you were just thrown off your land, your livestock would die. you know, and actually you'd have to go and do a day's work for these kids as well. And they would set the wages, they'd set the time you worked, and then the next step, as you all know, is industrialisation of this nation. Around the 1750s, the mass factories, the push-pull factories from the agricultural areas into the big cities. You know, and a lot of the people, I mean, that was probably one of the worst things. I mean, we can't imagine it, living like we do this day and age, but coming from an agricultural common land sort of background, being brought up like that, dancing around the maypole, if you like, you know, squashing your own apples to make cider, you know, having lots of nights around the fire, telling stories, to go into hovels, you know, where you're working 5 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock at night, all daylight hours, you know, your kids would be working with you in these unsanitary, horrible sort of spinning mills and such like, being beaten by the overseer. Who the fuck's he, do you know what I mean? Terrible changing working conditions and time as well. Before that, you know, we were more governed by the seasons and when the sun came up and such like, you know, when to plant what, you know, and such like. And all of a sudden we're governed by what time we have to clock in and what time we have to clock out, you know. And wages. You get X amount, it costs this. You're stuck, and it's like I was saying there earlier about where next one left, perhaps, you know. It's like, you know, a lot of the working classes, because I do represent in the trade union, you know, and a lot of people are very scared about going out and strike or taking any sort of action because they're maxed out on credit cards, they've got mortgages, and they're just frightened of losing what they've got. And most of them are zero contracts or flexi times, this, that, and the other. Anyway, I digress again. But the Enclosure Acts were struggled against. There was lots and lots of riots across the country. But unfortunately, on the whole, large amounts of the agricultural land in this country was enclosed and handed over to large farmers who then started to, you know, develop it for their own purposes, sell it to the market, or worse still, I mean, you must have heard about the Corn Acts, you know, where they're actually exporting corn past people who were starving. And there's certain, definitely there's riots in Bristol where actual ship has been unloaded on the quayside before it went to Ireland, you know, and the corn was distributed amongst the people, you know, during times of great dearth and people were actually starving and they were seeing it being shipped off, you know. And I mean, there's a couple of things I like to say. I'm going to say a bit of homework, actually. do your own local history. Have a little look for local enclosure acts or such like. They're quite easy to find because it's a bit like bankruptcy orders you see in the Morning Star. Even let's put it in Morning Star, don't they? You know, the enclosure acts. You know, if you'd have to warn people in the paper. I mean, obviously the people who actually lived on the common land probably didn't even buy a paper, you know, in the mountains, but if that was going to the papers, you could start there. But your records office and also public records office in Kew. So you get an idea on when the actual acts were brought in, if you like, in your local area, and then go back to the paper and see what the local people did about it. And 9 times out of 10, they struggled against it, and the riots were, I mean, it was before the spring riots, obviously, but it was probably the closest thing there to agricultural civil war at the time. And that was something else the rural classes fought about as well. They tried to spread it around, so it wasn't in one big area at once. So you'd have a massive great upheaval. And another thing we're thinking about doing in Bristol, keep it to yourselves, is building a one-day house on common land, just see if we can get away with it. You know, yeah. I mean, if there's a few of us got allotments, I've got allotment. I love it, the allotment. You know, it's eating your own vegetables, great. And also because now I'm a bit of a pen pusher, work for the trade union. You know, I like to keep my hands in, keep my hands dirty. So it's good for that, and all a bit of manual labour is good for the soul. But like, there's a few of us have got it. I mean, we think we've got the know-how. We're looking at it. One of us knows how to build a yurt. But I'm not sure, but you know, yurt is a Mongolian like teepee.
Just
yeah.
Round it. Pardon
me?
Just round
it. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. we'd lose on the technicality in court. But that'd be it, you know. We would like to throw up the structure, get the fire going, you know, and then get some access from B&Q and make merry. And you're more than welcome to come around for a cup of tea when it's finished. But I've finished there, is that alright, Dominic?
No.
Thank you.
You know, I've got time for questions, contributions, so just get your hand up.
Does Bristol have a piece of common land similar to Port Meadow, which is
I'm not too sure what Port Meadow is, but possibly. We've got Oldland Common and Syston Common, which is both by the cyclopath. I don't know if you... Cyclopath. I'm sorry, that's what we call it locally. There's reasons for it, obviously.
The cyclopath between Bath and Bristol.
That's the one, yeah.
I
live in Easton, you know what I mean? Yeah. That's a good place to throw an accent. Anyway, sorry. Yes, we do. We do. And basically, it's a similar sort of thing. I mean, the land's very uneven. There's a lot of firs and bracken on there and such like. Mm-hmm. That's what we're eyeing up, something like that. But the encroachment's already started because, like, there's a lot of housing estates that are going out of Bristol now. I mean, no one's got any money to bloody buy the things. You know, that's irrelevant, you know.
The commons that are left across Britain, yeah, managed in all sorts of different ways.
Yes.
They're all,
yes,
odds and sods.
Yeah.
Some of them in London, some of them are actually sort of managed, owned, if you like, by local councils who manage them as parks.
Yeah.
There's others that have got boards of conservators.
Yeah.
Some of them have got money that comes from people who still have some commoners' rights.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't use them, so like Wimbledon Common, people who live around Wimbledon Common, it's a very wealthy area, so they don't mind paying,
yeah,
but they don't exercise their rights to graze bison, you know.
There's that geese at Hampstead Common as well, weren't
there? Hampstead Common, I don't know what the state
is. He lived in the hedge for something like 25 years. I'm not taking the piss, you did, you know. He had a sort of wooden
front.
He had a right, and they had to bite off of it.
Yeah.
It was a six-figure fear, if I remember rightly. Sorry,
but I mean, the ways they're managed and the ways the management is funded,
yeah,
is very, very rare.
Yeah.
Mitcham Common, near where I live, they allowed a huge landfill 20, 30 years ago, put £3 million in the bank,
yeah,
and now they've got the money to manage it, to manage acid grassland and so on. So,
yeah,
rare habitats.
Yeah.
You know, so you wouldn't want to go squatting on that,
no,
taking a chunk of that.
No. Yeah.
I think right way across the country, it's all different, and I don't understand what the structure of the management, of the rules are, if you like, for common land.
Well, it's historic as well. It is really difficult to nail down, and it was really down. I mean, it grew out of the mannership, the court of manor, if you like, the manorial courts, I'll get them in the end. You know, and they had different ideas on how it should be managed. And as you correctly say, I mean, in some cases, it was a large landowner. There was a bit of a plant of his, if you like. He might have given it to the people of a certain town, city, as a convenant. Something like that, you know. Sometimes people, I mean, the documents of our side, if you like, it was the same for the ruling class at the time. They lost the documents and it just got lost in the sands of times, and no one knows who does actually own this. As I suggested earlier, everybody, all land was owned by somebody or other. A lot of it was around how it was worked as well. You know, the fen lands, I mean, no one cared about that, so they learned how to drain it. And that was another Cromwell's time. And they learned that from the Dutch, obviously, because they used
it.
Yeah, that's right, absolutely right, yeah. But, to be perfectly honest, it's mind-boggling for historians when I narrow it down. And I think that's one of the first things you've got to do. It's like, you know, it's all different. And just accept that as a given, really. You know, you just deal with your particular patches, like Kings of the Forest. You know, there's these four, we're called players. You know, and they had these liberties, if you like. They just encroached after the king was dead. And they were big squatters. It's like big squatter, little squatter. It's quite amusing in some ways.
You've talked a lot about agricultural,
yeah,
squatting and
yeah,
commons
ownership, yeah,
and stuff. But have you done any research into kind of squatting in urban settings, in town centres, and
yes and no.
Behind that.
Yes and no. Not in the same manner as this. I think what I was really interested with the agricultural and forest was the different layer, and like the sustainability of it. You know, you could literally live like that. If you squat in an urban area, it's got a large garden, I suppose.
Yeah.
Then you would still have to engage in wage slavery, I suppose that's what I'm looking at. But no, we're getting back to Colin Ward. I mean, he's very interesting, very, very lucid writer as well. He's very easy to read. So, you know, you can read one of his books in a couple of nights quite easily, you know. And he touches a lot on squatting and such like. And some of the law is the same. You know, once you've got a hold in, you know, like if as long as you don't break anything, you can stay there. And it's pretty much the same with a lot of common land, as long as you didn't debase it.
So,
you can stay
as long
there.
As one person is in the house at any one time, eventually it can,
yeah,
never be unoccupied.
Yeah. See, this is something else about the one-bay house. or in some cases, if there wasn't an NBN, then they could take it back.
Yeah.
You know, so they're the same sort of thing, someone would always have to be around there. And I'm jumping ahead of me. I mean, I said that the Kingswood Forest fell apart really in the early, I mean, it was after the Napoleonic War. And I got really interested in Kingswood Forest for the Cock Road Gang. I don't know if you've ever heard about them. But they were a criminal gang, and I was quite interested in the Cock Road Gang, which is a road that goes through Annam in the Kingswood Forest, but also it sits above the Bristol Bath Road, so they could watch the mail coach. But I was quite interested because they were outlaws, but actual criminality, if you like, as a part of the class struggle. You know, they did operate as a very close-knit gang. But basically, when the militia eventually went in, there was actually a pitched battle in there, about 3-4 days. But part of the battle was when someone vacated the house, then the actual militia took it back over and they'd lost all their rights to it. So not only might they be incarcerated, but once the house was taken, that land had fallen, if you like. And of course, one of the downsides of that as well was, as I said earlier, some of the coal mines got together as a conglomerate, so then that land was sort of given to coal mines, so that nailed it down fully, you know. And of course, the family were normally in Nick, you know, and the kids would be sent on the poor law. Horrible.
You seem to be very pro kind of the individual and maybe the families as a unit, but not kind of organised. Struggle in terms of kind of unions and things like that. Because I would see the kind of the people of the Kingswood mining and getting together as an organised group as probably a positive thing.
Yes. Maybe I've made myself clear. No, you're completely right. No, I am a trade unionist, actually.
Yeah.
I am very much into collective bargaining. You know, I'm not into collective bargaining, and then you get the carpet pulled out underneath you by region.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what I'm saying about the conglomerate, bringing together the mines, is that normally it was under capitalist guys, and there'd be one or two people that actually be taking the money, and then everybody start working for them, if you like. You know,
okay.
So they'd be selling the rights more than. Sometimes that would come through by families. You know, so there'd be a couple of brothers that gang together, and then eventually one brother would rise to the top, if you like, you know. But on the whole thing about commons and the whole thing about the struggle to retain the commons was on a collective basis, very much so. And Kingswood Forest, I mean, getting back to the Battle of 1817, you know, just about the whole forest turned out. They armed themselves and they turned out. You know, and the shoulder stuff. There's a lovely story as well. Do you ever heard about the side attacks in 1766? Brilliant idea. The Georgians, I think it was Walpole, had a bright idea, attack cider. And that cider was very much an agricultural working class drink, very much so. And they actually got the tax inspectors had to go out and see the cider presses and basically all the cider houses and charge people, tax them. For either pressing the cider, making the cider, or flogging the cider. And I don't know if they read the small print down the job centre, but it was not a popular job. You know, a lot of them had a really hard time in Kingswood. A couple of them turned up and cut a long story, they put them down a mine and left them there until they promised to stop being silly and go away, basically. And when they promised to stop being silly, they ate them up and then they charged them for bed and breakfast as well. And I just thought that was brilliant, you know. And that was community, you know. No, we're not paying more for our side. It's our side. It's our apples. It's our trees. Mm-hmm. Do one, very much like that, you know. Yeah. No, I obviously didn't explain myself properly. Yes. You're like, no, it's fine. No, if I am.
I suppose I need to. Big guys would be more interested in buying the conglomerate of 3-4 of these smaller miners.
Yeah.
Than the small bit, which is where you lost your rights by, in the end, all working together when it was working brilliantly, and then suddenly one of the big guys thinks, that looks interesting. This is what happens to us all the way through history.
Short termism as well.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
a few bucks in the.
Absolutely.
You pocket now and nothing in the future.
You can imagine someone who struggled out of mouth, you know, with five kids or something, you know, living down, working 12 hours down the dark hole, you know, just waiting for death. Because it was a very dangerous job, very, very dangerous. And then someone offers him a fiver. You know, it's nothing to us, obviously, but in there, that day and age, I mean, that was an astronomical. I mean, the reason I'm saying this is because I know that was one of the deals that was done, you know. And that actually family went off to America to start a new life. You know, I mean, that's something else. I mean, some people actually chose transportation because it was seen as better than wage labour.
Well, there's a letter in the Bedfordshire magazine that says that, writing back, you know, yeah. So, you know, if it's nice here, yeah. I get fed.
But it wasn't completely idyllic, you know. I like the thoughts of like kids trotting about the meadow, you know, as the sun goes down, you know. It was hard work, there's no doubt about it. And if you count either the disease, you were that good, you know. And if the cops found or something, you know, or if there was a fire in the fur, you know, yeah, anything could happen. But on the whole, the community response was solid.
You know, there's a kind of one global dimension to this, you know, because the thing I've got Papua New Guinea, I think, some years ago, I read a World Bank report saying that they had to do something about the people living there because there's no way, because they couldn't get them to work in the mines. You know, these people they don't actually lack anything. They're quite seriously, they've got to find ways of creating needs that actually can work. That's one. You know, there's all sorts. They actually do seem to succeed now. Because I read the course about. A mine that actually have succeeded in building in this area. Right. You know, it's ghastly what they're doing. They actually have immiserated this whole people. But that's a development model, though, isn't it? Right. You know, what was done to the people here is parcelled up in pretty string and called a development model, and sold to people, sold to ruling classes all over the world.
Yeah. Well, that's very important as well. I mean, during the harvest, they stopped mining. In the early days, and one of my favourite stories is of the Xhosa people in South Africa.
The Xhosa people,
yes. Yeah. And they worked down the gold mines for the Boers for a bit, you know, and then they just wandered off for the harvest, you know, and they didn't really come back. It wasn't worth it, you know. Like the Boers just couldn't get their heads around it, you know.
Yeah.
So obviously, then they encroached on their land, and so they could no longer work that land. And we have the First Boer War, and then the Xhosas ended up down the mines as they still are now.
Do you know much about the productivity of peasant agriculture? Because this kind of, you know, the counter propaganda,
yes.
Against
what we're talking, yes.
Oh, well, yes, all very well being sentimental about this kind of thing, but you can't think of the nation and some sort of profit on this kind of thing. But yes, from the little as that's what, you know, the permaculture people,
yes.
Forest garden, we're talking about enormous productivity that can be got on, on sort of small plots, gardening.
Yes.
I'd love to hear about that fully developed rationale for utterly, you know, roughly transforming society onto a kind of a commons basis.
See, I agree. I think you know, both sides have got some rationale there. You know, however, the main farms were normally monoculture. Wheat, normally for export, okay, to the cities, but sometimes abroad. And what you just said about the permaculture, where you actually work on the land all year, you couldn't really do that on a large scale farm.
Yeah.
And my personal feeling is what you could do is you could still have the common land, but like I said about the blacksmith and the miner, you could also have agricultural workers that are working on larger bits of land for export to the city.
Mm.
You know, yeah, that's perfectly possible. In fact, rational, I would say.
Yes.
You know.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, I think one of the things I found most upsetting is what I was talking about earlier about the industrialisation and just the break of modernity. You know, we've lost our land, if you like. You know, and it's, you know, we all pay exorbitant rents. I mean, it is the majority of our wages really goes on housing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And associated costs, like, you know. Gas and electricity and such like, and that's why we have to work. You know, most Monday mornings I'd much rather not. You know, Tuesdays as well. Okay, is there anything else? It's been lovely to meet you, and I must admit, a lot of respect to the first world people. have sorted this out today, you know, because there's been a bit going on recently. I don't know if anybody went to the Cardiff Anarchist Book Fair, and, you know, there's going to be the Bristol Anarchist Book Fair quite soon. Hopefully you see some of you there, you know. There's loads more book fairs going on. Great interest in meeting together in the same room, you know, and having discussions, you know, dropping, you know, some of the side issues that we have, you know, between the trots.
The headline issues.
Exactly. Yeah. And what we've got to do is all get together and just make the world a bit of a better place and then argue about the semantics later, won't we? Mm. Yeah.